We did not have conversations. Talking with my mother was more like taking a series of oral quizzes on subjects ranging from feminism to socialism to my feelings about my own sexual identity. She would sometimes ask me to sit on the couch with her so she could read me an article about genital mutilation from National Geographic. She would announce that the practice of women shaving their armpits was a form of patriarchal control, and then look at me with a certain hostile fascination, as if she expected me to disapprove of the wiry gray thatch beneath her arms. Once I asked my father why they didn't live together, and he said because she was brilliant. She was, too, I think. I've read her books, and they aren't what you'd call page-turners, but I admire the way she could fold together a series of small observations and then suddenly spread them out before you, open them like a fan, to reveal a single great insight. Her curiosities gripped her entirely, held her transfixed. I don't think there was room in her head to wonder about her husband and son. I stretched out on the couch, underneath the picture window, in the dimness of the living room. I was running my thumb along the edge of the photo in my shirt pocket for maybe half a minute before I realized what I was doing. A part of me didn't want to look at it now or ever, which was a peculiar way to feel. It was, after all, just a photo of me sitting next to the soda machine reading a magazine. There was nothing wrong with it, as long as you didn't know that it had been taken today but showed something that had happened days or maybe weeks ago. A part of me didn't want to look at it, and a part of me couldn't help myself. I picked it out of my pocket and tilted it to examine it in the afternoon's weird storm light. If ghosts have a color, then they are the color of an August thunderstorm getting ready to break. The sky was the exact filthy gray of a Polaroid just beginning to develop. In the photograph, I hunched over that crumpled copy of Popular Mechanics, looking fat and unlovely. The fluorescent lighting above gave me the bluish tinge of the undead in a George Romero picture. "Don't let him take a picture of you," Shelley Bukes had told me. "Don't let him start taking things away." But he hadn't taken a picture of me. I was in the picture, but he hadn't pointed his camera at me and pressed the button. In fact, he hadn't taken a picture at all. I had, and I'd been pointing the Solarid at Matt. I dropped the photo with a kind of revulsion, as if I had suddenly realized I was holding a squirming maggot. For a while, I sprawled in the shadowy cool, trying not to think because everything in my head was rotten and strange. Ever try not to think? It's like trying not to breathe. No one can do it for long. Maturity is not something that happens all at once. It is not a border between two countries where once you cross the invisible line, you are on the new soil of adulthood, speaking the foreign tongue of grown-ups. It is more like a distant broadcast. And you are driving toward it, and sometimes you can barely make it out through the hiss of static, while other times the reception momentarily clears, and you can pick up the signal with perfect clarity. I think I was listening for Radio Adulthood then, remaining perfectly still, in the hopes that I could catch a transmission carrying useful news and emergency instructions. I can't say anything came to me, but in that moment of enforced stillness, my gaze happened to settle on the small collection of family photo albums that my dad had arranged on the top shelf of the bookcase in the corner. My dad liked to keep things in order. He wore a tool belt to work, and everything was always in just the right place. The pliers in a holster, the wire stripper snug in a loop that was meant for it. I picked an album at random, dumped myself back onto the couch, and began to turn through the pages. The oldest photos were glossy rectangular squares, and, hold on to your hats, kids, I'm not making this up, were in black and white. The earliest showed my parents together in the days before they married. They were both too old and too square to be hippies, and I'm not sure I can honestly describe them as an appealing couple. My father's only concessions to the time period were bushy sideburns and tinted sunglasses. My mother, the great African anthropologist, wore khaki shorts pulled up above her belly button and heavy hiking boots, even to family reunions. She smiled like it pained her. There wasn't one shot of them hugging or kissing or even looking at each other. There were at least a few shots of them taking turns holding me. Here was my mother on the floor, dangling enormous rubber keys above a chubby infant on his back, who grasped at them with fat fingers. Here was a picture of my father, up to his waist in someone's above-ground swimming pool, clutching his naked toddler in his arms. I was already a butterball. My most frequent companion, though, was not my father or my mother, but Shelley Bukes. It was kind of a shock, really. When she retired 5 years earlier, I'd felt nothing in particular, was as indifferent as I would have been if my father had told me we were replacing an end table. Are you shocked to hear that a privileged 7-year-old me from the valley took the help for granted? My dad didn't talk to me then about her open heart surgery. He just said that she was a little older and older people needed more rest. She was in the neighborhood and I could go see her any time. And did I? Oh, I dropped in on rare occasions for tea and date cookies, and we sat in front of Murder, She Wrote, and she asked me how I was doing. I'm sure I was polite and ate my cookies quickly so I could go. When you're a kid spending an afternoon in an overheated living room with an old lady in front of daytime television is like winning a ticket to Guantanamo Bay. Love doesn't figure into it. Whatever I owed her or whatever I might have meant to her never entered into my thoughts. But here she was, in photo after photo. We clutched the bars of a jail cell in Alcatraz, both of us putting on mock horrified faces. I sat on her shoulders to pluck a peach from the branches of a peach tree, my free hand crushing the brim of her straw hat down into her face. I blew out candles while she stood behind me, hands raised, ready to clap. And yes, by this stage, the pictures were all Polaroids. Of course we had one. Everyone had one. Just like everyone had a VCR, a microwave, and a Where's the Beef t-shirt. The woman in these photos was old, but had bright, almost girlish eyes and a mischievous smile to match. In one Polaroid, her hair was the red of a neon beer sign in a bar. In another, it was a comical shade of carrot, and her nails were painted to match. In the snapshots, she was always grabbing me, tousling my hair, sitting with me in her lap while I ate one of her date-filled cookies, a chubby little kid in Spider-Man underoos with grape juice stains on his chin. About 2/3 of the way through the book, I came across a photo of a long-forgotten backyard barbecue. Shelley's hair was arctic blue-colored this time. She had Larry with her, the Afrikaner wearing two tight sand-colored trousers and a white button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled back to display his Popeye forearms. Each of them had one of my hands. I was a blur swinging between them in the dusk. Shelley was frozen in the act of whooping. Bemused grown-ups stood around watching, holding plastic cups of white wine. The idea that these days had been taken from her struck me as vile. It was a swallow of curdled milk. It was indecent. There was no justification for the loss of her memories and understanding, no defense the universe could offer for the corruption of her mind. She had loved me, even if I'd been too witless to know it or value it. Anyone who looked at these pictures could see she loved me, that I delighted her somehow, in spite of my fat cheeks, vacant stare, and tendency to eat in a way that smeared food all down my bad t-shirts. In spite of how I thoughtlessly accepted her attention and affection as might do, and now it was all melting away. Every birthday party, every barbecue, every plucked ripe peach. She was being erased a little at a time by a cancer that fed not on her flesh, but on her inner life, on her private store of happiness. The thought made me want to fling the photo album at a wall. It made me feel like crying. Instead, I swiped at the water in my eyes and flipped to the next page and made a sound of surprise at what I found there. When I had glanced into the back of the Phoenician's car, I'd seen a photo of a bodybuilder, a darkly tanned youth in an orange tank top, perched on the hood of a Trans Am. Some part of me had recognized him, had known I'd seen him before, even though I couldn't place him or guess where we'd crossed paths. And here he was again, in my own photo album. He held two straight-backed chairs over his head, one in each hand, gripping each by a wooden leg. I sat in one, hollering in what looked like joyous terror. I was in a damp swimsuit, jewels of water glittering on my fat boy boobs. Shelley Bukes sat in the other, gripping the seat with both hands, laughing with her head tipped back slightly. In this photograph, the big guy was dressed not in a tank top, but in navy whites. He grinned wolfishly beneath his Tom Selleck mustache. And, look, even the Trans Am was there. I could just see the rear end of it, sitting in the driveway, visible around one corner of Shelley's house. "Who the hell are you?" I whispered. I was talking to myself and didn't expect an answer, but my father said, "Who?" He stood in the doorway to the kitchen, wearing a single oven mitt. I wasn't sure how long he'd been standing there, watching me. "Guy with the muscles," I said, gesturing at a picture he couldn't see from halfway across the room. He wandered over, craned his neck for a look. "Oh, that jackass. Shelley's boy. Sinbad, Achilles, something like that. That's the day before he shipped out to the Red Sea. Shelley had a going-away barbecue at her house. She made a cake, looked like a battleship, and was almost as big. We brought home the leftovers, and you and I ate battleship for breakfast all week." I remembered that cake. A three-dimensional aircraft carrier, not a battleship, churning up waves of blue-white frosting. I also remembered, faintly, that Shelley had told me that the party was a graduation party for me. I had just finished the third grade. What a Shelley Bukes thing to do. Tell a lonely little kid that a party was all about him, when it had nothing to do with him at all. "He doesn't look so bad," I said. It bothered me, my dad calling him a jackass. It seemed like an offhand criticism of Shelley herself, and I wasn't in the mood. "Oh, you loved him. He was Larry's boy through and through. Competed in bodybuilding contests, liked to show off with his muscle boy tricks. Pick up one end of a car with his dick or whatever. You used to think he was the Incredible Hulk. I remember that stunt, picking both of you up at the same time and walking around with you while you balanced on those chairs. I was afraid he'd drop Shelley on her head and I'd have to find a new babysitter. Or he'd drop you and I'd have to find a new kid to eat my Panama Thrill. Come on, food's done, let's tuck in." We sat catty-cornered to each other at the dinner table with the Battle of Stalingrad on our plates. I wasn't hungry and was surprised when I found myself using a roll to mop up the last of the gravy. I moved my bread around and around, smearing juice and thinking of all those photo albums in the back of the Phoenician's car. Thinking of the picture in my shirt pocket that showed something it couldn't possibly show. An idea was developing, not unlike a Polaroid, swimming slowly, inevitably into clarity. In a distant, artificially calm voice, I said, "I saw Mrs. Bukes today." "Oh, yeah?" My father gave me a thoughtful glance, then asked in a mild tone that was as artificial as mine, "How'd she look?" "She was lost. I walked her home." "I'm glad. I wouldn't have expected you to do anything different." I told him about finding Shelley in the street and how she thought she was supposed to work today and how she wouldn't say my name because she didn't know it. I told him about Larry Bukes swerving into the driveway in a panic, how he'd been scared to death she might go wandering into traffic or wind up lost for good. He gave me money for bringing her home. I didn't want to take it, but he made me. I didn't think my dad would like that, and part of me expected, was maybe even hoping, to be shamed. But instead, he got up for the Panama Thrill and said over his shoulder, "Good." "It is?" He set down the Jell-O, wobbling under 4 inches of sherbet-colored whipped cream, and began to scoop globs of it into bowls. "Sure. Paying you is the way a man like Lawrence Bukes makes himself feel that he's back in control. He's not a man who lost his senile wife because he's too old to see to her needs himself. He's a man who knows how to pay someone to solve a problem. He asked if I'd help out sometimes. If I'd, you know, come by and sit with her when he has to go out for groceries or whatever. My dad paused with a spoonful of Panama Thrill at his lips. I'm glad. You're good to help out. I know you love that old lady. Funny, huh? My father had known I loved Shelley Bukes, something I hadn't known myself until only a few minutes before. Anything else happened this morning? He asked. My thumb crept to my shirt pocket, ran along the edge of the Polaroid. Solarid? There. I'd been touching it off and on, in a nervous, relentless, helpless way, ever since getting home. I considered saying something about the Phoenician and the clash at the Mobile Mini Mart, but I didn't know how to bring such a thing up without sounding like a rattled little kid. And then there was that idea creeping around the edge of my awareness, a thought I was studiously trying to ignore. I didn't want to go anywhere near that idea, and if I started talking about the Phoenician, I wouldn't be able to avoid it. So I didn't say anything about the run-in at the gas station. Instead, I said, I'm almost done working on the party gun. Outstanding. It'll be easy to celebrate when you're finished. All you have to do is pull the trigger. He got up and carried our plates to the sink. Mike? Yeah? Don't get too down if Shelley doesn't know you or says things that don't make sense. I won't. It's like a house after someone moves out. The house is still there, but all their stuff is gone. Someone took away the furniture and rolled up the rugs. The movers crated all the parts of Shelley Bukes up and shipped her away. There's just not much left of her anymore, except the empty house. He scraped the ruins of Stalingrad into the disposal. That, and what's in old photographs. 5. You'll be all right here? My father asked me on his way out the door. He had one foot on the front step and the other on our pea-green shag carpet. Lightning lit the low boiling clouds behind him in a soundless flicker. Been a while since I needed Shelley Bukes to tuck me in, I said. Yeah, it has. I don't know that's how it should be, but that's how it is, huh? That was such an uncharacteristic thing for my dad to say. To acknowledge, even a little, that our life was somehow not quite ideal, that I opened my mouth to answer him and found I had no reply at all. He glanced out into the turbulent, thundercloudy dusk. I hate working nights. When Al gets back in the rotation, I'll put in for days. My father had been pulling night shifts with the utility company all summer. They had a staffing gap. His best pal, Al Murdoch, wasn't working while he received treatment for lymphoma. One of the line engineers, John Hawthorne, had recently been arrested for assaulting his ex-wife. Piper Wilson had left to have a baby. Suddenly, my father was the senior lineman and working 60 hours a week, most of them after I went to bed. At first, I liked it. I liked staying up after I was supposed to be asleep, catching softcore porn on what we called Skinamax in those days. But by mid-July, all the fun had gone out of being alone in the house at night. I had a vivid imagination, and in late July had made the mistake of reading Zodiac. After that, the emptiness of the house began to seriously creep me the fuck out. I'd lie in bed, dry-mouthed at 2 in the morning. Listening to the silence, breathlessly expecting to hear a splintering crunch as good old Zodiac forced open a window with a crowbar. He'd use one of the kitchen knives to cut astrological signs into my fat gut, not after I was dead, but while I was still alive, so he could hear me shriek. I never talked about any of this with my father, because the only thing worse than my nighttime anxiety attacks was the idea that he might decide to hire someone to babysit me. All the Zodiac killer could do was torture and kill me. If my dad hired some teenage valley girl to put me to bed at 9:30 and then spend the rest of the night on our phone jawing with her friends, I'd wish I were dead. The indignity would stomp up and down on my brittle 13-year-old boy's ego. After my run-in with the Phoenician, I especially dreaded being alone that evening. Plus, there were those thunderheads and a sense of electrical charge in the air, a prickling energy I could feel in the fine hairs on my forearms. The thunder had been rolling all afternoon, and you could just tell it was going to cut loose soon. Cut loose and roar. "Think you'll work on the party gun some more?" he asked. "Probably. I..." What followed was not melodramatic horror movie thunder, but more like a world-splitting sci-fi missile launch, a single obliterating cannon blast. It was noise at such a volume that it drove the air out of me. My father would spend his evening offered up to that sky on an iron crane, repairing power lines, a thought that made my insides bunch up with worry when I allowed myself to think about it. He only looked disgruntled and a little weary, as if the thunder were a tiresome irritation, like the sound of kids fighting in the back seat. He cupped one hand behind his right ear to indicate he hadn't heard me. "I almost had it working this afternoon when Shelley showed up. If I finish, I'll show you tomorrow." "That's good. You have to hurry up and make your first $1 million so I can retire and focus on what I really love, doing original things with Jell-O." My father took a few steps down to his panel van, then turned back, frowning. "I want you to call if..." There was another cannonade of thunder. My father went right on talking, but I didn't hear a word. That was very like him. He had an unmatched gift for tuning out background details that didn't concern him. The Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders could have romped by, naked, shaking their pom-poms, and if he was up in his crane repairing a transformer, I doubt he would have so much as glanced down. I nodded as if I'd heard him. I supposed he was dishing out a standard issue caution for me to call the office and have them radio him if anything came up. He waved and turned away. A blue light snapped on, high in the clouds, a flash on the world's biggest camera. I flinched. "Don't let him take your picture," and half shut the front door. The headlights of the panel van blinked on, and the afternoon blinked off in the same moment. It was only 6:15 in mid-August, and the sun wouldn't be down for another 3 hours. But the day was lost in a smothering darkness. The van backed away. I closed the door. 6. I don't know how long I stood in the foyer, listening to the tick of my pulse in my ears. The taut, expectant hush of the afternoon held me in place. At some point I realized I had my hand over my heart, as if I were a child about to pledge allegiance. No, not over my heart. Over the Polaroid. I had a powerful impulse to get rid of it, to throw it away. It felt awful to have it there in my pocket. Awful and dangerous, like walking around with a vial of infected blood. I even went into the kitchen and opened the cupboard under the sink, meaning to cram it down into the garbage. But when it slipped out of my pocket, I just stood there looking at it, looking at the fat, red-faced boy in a Huey Lewis t-shirt bent over Popular Mechanics. "Have we met before?" Matt asked, smiling apologetically. A flash snapped outside, and I lurched back, dropped the photo. When I looked up, for an instant, I saw him, the Phoenician, right on the other side of the kitchen window. "And don't let him take your picture! Oh God, don't let him!" But it wasn't the Phoenician with the Solarid. The flash was only another blue crackle of lightning. The face I saw in the window was my own, a faint reflection suspended in the glass. When the next crash of thunder came, I was in the garage. I carefully set the snapshot down, aligning it with the edge of my work table. I switched on my Luxo lamp and twisted its hinged arm to nail the picture down in a hot circle of white light. Finally, and with a kind of nasty pleasure, I stuck a pushpin through the top to hold it in place. I felt better then. It was in my operational theater now, fastened to my autopsy table. This was where I pried things apart and made them tell me everything, all their powers and vulnerabilities. To add to my feeling of confidence and control, I unbuttoned my pants and let them fall around my ankles and stepped out of them. I had discovered some time ago that nothing frees the mind like dropping the pants. Try it if you doubt me. American productivity would, I believe, nearly double if everyone were free to work pantsless. Just to show the photo who was boss, I ignored it and worked on the party gun. I squeezed the trigger to hear the fan whir inside the casing. I unbolted the side and lifted out the circuit board, picked and prodded at it. At first, I was distracted. I kept looking at the picture that had no right to exist, and then, when I turned back to my new toy, I couldn't remember what I'd been doing. After a while, though, I settled into my own capsule of focus, and the Phoenician, Shelley Bukes, the Solarid, all of it went gray, like a Polaroid developing in reverse, returning to unmixed blank chemicals. I soldered and wired. It was warm in the garage, and fragrant with that smell I still love, melted rubber and hot copper and oil. I had oil on one of my hands, a little WD-40, and I wiped it with a rag to expose pink skin. I studied the rag, watched the way the ink stains spread, leaching into the fabric, sponged away, absorbed. I had snapped a picture of Mobile Station Matt, Yoshi Matsuzaka, but what the Solarid captured was something in his head. A picture he held in his mind of me. It soaked it up, like the rag in my fist absorbing oil. Blue light flashbulbed outside the windows. I was not alarmed. The idea, when it came to me, was no shock. I suppose, down below the level of my conscious mind, I already knew. I believe that our subconscious often finishes ideas hours, days, weeks, even years before it decides to present them to the higher reaches of the brain. And after all, Shelley had already explained everything to me. Don't let him take a picture of you. Don't let him start taking things away. It's odd that when I knew, when I understood, I wasn't more afraid. That I didn't go clammy and shivery and try to tell myself I was being crazy. Instead, I was almost serene. I remember, I calmly turned a shoulder to the photo and bent back to the party gun, screwing it together again, and then shaking a packet of glitter down into the barrel, loading it like a musket. I behaved as if I had solved a math problem of no particular import. The last part of the gun was the flash, which could be snapped into the top, where a sharpshooter might put his scope. I had, in fact, swiped the disposable flash from our own Polaroid for this purpose. I held the flash in my hand, as if I were weighing it, and thought of the camera going off in Matt's face, that hot white snap of light, and how he had staggered away, blinking rapidly. I thought of Shelley Bukes casting her baffled stare around the neighborhood she'd lived in for at least 2 decades, looking as dazed as if a flash had just gone off in her face. I thought about the black photo albums in the back of the Phoenician's caddy. I thought about the photo I'd seen in one of them, a photo that was almost certainly of Shelley's own son. There was a long, rolling peal of thunder that seemed to cause the whole garage to shudder, and afterward the air rang strangely. Then I decided I was the one shuddering, and abruptly I stood up, feeling dizzy. I switched off the Luxo and stood in the dark, taking deep breaths of the coppery-smelling air. I wondered if I was going to be sick. The ringing sound in my ears went on, and all at once it came to me that I wasn't hearing an aftershock from the thunder. Someone was leaning on the doorbell. I was afraid to answer it. By some 13-year-old logic, I felt sure it had to be the Phoenician who somehow knew I had solved the riddle of his Solarid and was here to shut me up forever. I looked around for something I could use as a weapon, considered the screwdriver, then took the party gun instead. I had the wild idea that in the shadows of the foyer it might look like a real gun. As I approached the front door, the storm clouds launched a fresh salvo of house-shaking thunder, and I heard a whispered curse in a heavy South African brogue. My anxiety drained away, leaving my legs loosey-goosey and my head light. I cracked the door and said, "Hi, Mr. Bukes." His Rock Hudson features were haggard, deeply lined, and his lips were discolored as if he'd been walking for a long time in the cold. He might have aged 10 years since I'd last seen him. For all the crashing and flaring lights, it still wasn't raining. The wind, though, lashed at his trench coat, so it flapped frantically around his massive torso and narrow hips. It was the same coat Shelley had been wearing that morning. It looked better on him. The gale flung his silver hair across his seamed, bold forehead. "Michael," he said, "I did not expect I would have need of you so soon, or on a night like this. I am so sorry. I'm just... Oh, God, what a day. I am sure you must be busy doing something with your friends. I hate on such short notice." Under other circumstances, this would have sounded like the setup for a punchline. I was less a social butterfly than a social death's head moth. But in the rushing darkness of that storm that refused to break, I hardly registered his line about how I must be doing something with my friends. The storm. The feeling of electric charge in the air. Mr. Bukes's strained, raspy breath and all the strangeness of the day had me keyed up, almost quivering with tension. Yet for all that, I wasn't surprised to see him on the front step. Some part of me had been expecting him all afternoon, had been waiting for the third act of today's performance to begin, the conclusion to an absurdist drama in which I was both the lead and the audience. "What's up, Mr. Bukes? Is Shelley all right?"
"Is she?"
"Yes."
"No."
He laughed bitterly.
"You know how she is. At the moment, she is asleep. I have to go out. Something has happened. Today, I am a man in a sinking boot, trying to bail out the water with a spoon."
It took me a moment to realize that sinking boot was Larry Bukes's for sinking boat.
"What happened?" "Do you remember what I told you about my gyms? How there is always a fire to put out?"
He laughed again, bleakly.
"I should watch my metaphors. My gym, the one next to the micro center, there has been a fire. An actual fire. No one is hurt, thank God for his blessings. It was closed. The fire department extinguished the blaze, but I must go inspect the damage."
"What kind of fire?" He wasn't expecting that question, and it took him a beat to process it. I don't blame him for being surprised. I was surprised, too. I didn't know I was going to ask him that until I heard the question come out of my mouth.
I think it must be the lightning. They didn't say. I hope it is the lightning and not old wiring. The insurance company will heave me by my shriveled old ball sack."
I barked with laughter at this passing mention of his shriveled old ball sack. I had never heard an adult, let alone an elderly man like Lawrence Bukes, speak to me this way, with a profane, desperate honesty, with such a mix of black humor and undisguised vulnerability. It was a jolting experience. At the same time, I had a thought. Two simple, dreadful words. "It's him," and felt a light touch of vertigo. Thoughts flashed by like cards glimpsed as the dealer shuffles the deck. "Tell him not to go," I thought. But there'd been a fire, and he had to go, and I had no argument to make him stay. None that made sense. If I told him there was a man with a camera that stole thoughts circling his wife, he would never let me near Shelley again. In that case, he might stay home, to protect her from me. I thought, he will go, and I will call the police and warn them his wife is in danger. Again, I asked myself, in danger from what? From who? A man with a Polaroid camera? I was 13, not 30, and my dread, my anxieties would count for nothing with the police. I would sound like a hysterical child. Also, a quadrant in my brain held out hope that I was only scaring myself with a lunatic ghost story, the result of a childhood spent reading too many comic books and watching too many episodes of The Tomorrow People. The rational counter-argument presented itself to me in a series of forceful, unequivocal points. Shelley Bukes did not suffer from a curse inflicted by a knockoff Polaroid. She was the victim of Alzheimer's disease, no magical explanation required. As for the snapshot that showed me reading Popular Mechanics, so what? Someone must have taken my picture weeks ago, and at the time, I hadn't noticed. Simple explanations have the disappointing tendency to be the best explanations. Only the rational counterargument was a pile of shit, and I knew it. I knew it. I just didn't want to know it. All this flickered through my mind in a moment. The wind blew a can rattling down the road, and Mr. Bukes turned to watch it go, then cast a distraught and distracted look at his idling town car.
I will drive you, this weather. If not for this morning, I might have risked leaving her by herself tonight. She has had the pill for her arthritis, and she sleeps so heavy, sometimes 10 hours. But tonight there is the thunder. What if she wake up and is afraid? You must imagine me very wicked to have left her, even for a minute.
At not quite 13, I wasn't emotionally equipped to respond to a distressed and elderly man, viciously finding fault with himself. I mumbled some eloquent words of comfort, like, no, not at all.
I tried to dial you, but when there was no answer, I think he is in his garage and cannot hear the phone ringing. I kissed her goodbye, very softly so not to wake her, and came straight over.
He showed me a smile that was close to a grimace.
When she is asleep, she looked like her old self. Sometimes I think in her dreams she gets it all back. The path to her old self is overgrown, lost in the briars. But her sleeping mind... You think, Michael, the sleeping mind has paths of its own? Trails the waking self has never walked?
I don't know, Mr. Bukes. He dismissed his own question with a weary nod.
Come, I will drive you now. You should get a book, maybe, and I don't know what else.
He lowered his eyes, took in the fact that I was wearing boxers and socks. He lifted one white, stupendously shaggy eyebrow.
Trousers, perhaps.
I don't need you to drive me around the corner. Go see if your gym is okay, and don't worry about Shelley. I'll be over there in 5 minutes. Thunder growled at his back. He cast another aggrieved look up at the sky, then leaned through the door and took my hand in both of his.
You are a good damn kid, he announced. Shelley always taught me this, you know, every time she came home. That is a good damn kid, Larry. All the funny things he talks about building. Beware, Afrikaner. I will ask him to build me a new husband, one who doesn't shave in the shower, so it looks like a ferret exploded in there.
He smiled at the memory, while the rest of his face crumpled. And for a horrible moment, I thought he was going to cry again. Instead, he lifted his hand and rested it on the back of my neck.
Good damn kid, she said. She always knew when someone had greatness in them. She didn't waste her time with second-rate people, not never. Only the best, always.
Always? I asked. He shrugged.
She married me, didn't she?
And winked.
7.
On the way to collect my pants, I took a detour into the kitchen and dialed Norwest Utility. I knew the direct number to the switchboard by heart and thought maybe they could patch me straight through to my dad's radio. I wanted to let him know where I was going to be. I thought there was a very reasonable chance I'd wind up sacking out on the Bukes' couch that evening. Only no one picked up on the other end because it never rang. There was just a long, dead hiss. I hung up and was about to try again when I realized there wasn't any dial tone. It came to me, suddenly, that it was very dim in the kitchen. Experimentally, I flipped the light switch. The room didn't get any brighter. I went to the picture window in the living room and looked out at the dead street. Not a light on in a single window, in spite of the darkness of the day. The Ambersons, across the road, always had their TV on by mid-afternoon, but tonight there was no spectral blue glow pulsing in the windows of the den. At some point, while Mr. Bukes and I had been talking, a line had gone down somewhere, cutting the juice to the whole neighborhood. I thought, no, it's him. My stomach flopped. Suddenly, I wanted to sit down. The aftertaste of Panama Thrill was in my mouth, a flavor like sweet bile. The house buckled in the wind, creaking and popping. Probably a lot of lines were going down tonight. As far as that went, it was entirely credible to imagine that the fire at the gym had something to do with the storm. A fire that had conveniently left Shelley all alone, with no way to raise an alarm if there was trouble, because even if she could remember how to call the police, her phone would be as dead as mine. I considered running across the road and beating a fist on Mr. Amberson's door and yelling for help, and then what? What was I going to tell him? That I was afraid a cruel man with tattoos had engineered a fire and a power outage so he could take Polaroids of a senile old woman? Let me tell you how that would look. Like a fat kid with a head full of horror movies getting hysterical because of a little thunder and lightning. I wondered if I could just stay home. I don't like admitting that, but it crossed my mind that Mr. Bukes would never really know if I'd walked over to watch his wife. Yeah, sure, in a couple of hours he would get back from his gym and I wouldn't be there, but I could always bullshit him, say I'd only gone home for a minute to get my pillow and was coming right back. The idea briefly filled me with a shameful throb of relief. I could stay home, and if the Phoenician came and did something to Shelley, something awful, I wouldn't be in the way and wouldn't have to know. I was only 13, and no one could expect me to try to protect a mentally crippled old woman from a sadistic freak with a mile of ink on his body. I was afraid to go, but in the end, I was even more afraid to stay. I envisioned Mr. Bukes coming home and finding Shelley toppled out of bed, her neck snapped, head turned halfway around to look back between her shoulder blades. When I closed my eyes, I could see it. Her lips wrinkled in a grimace of terror and anguish, her stiffening corpse surrounded by hundreds of Polaroid snapshots. If the Phoenician visited her while I cowered at home, I might be able to lie my way out of it with Mr. Bukes, but I could not lie my way out of it with myself. The guilt would be too much. It would rot my insides and spoil every good thing in my life. Worst of all, I felt that my dad would somehow intuit my cowardice and I'd never be able to look him in the eye again. He would know I hadn't really gone to watch Mrs. Bukes. I'd never been any good at lying to him, not about anything that mattered. One idea got me into my pants and out the door. I thought maybe I could just creep up to the house and peek in the windows. If Mrs. Bukes was alone and asleep in her bed, if all was clear, I could park myself in the kitchen with a knife in one hand and my party gun in the other, next to the back door, ready to run and scream like hell if anyone tried to force his way into the house. I still thought, in the late day gloom, that the party gun might make someone hesitate for a moment, and if it didn't fool anyone, I could always throw it. Before I left, I sat down at the kitchen table to write a note for my father. I wanted to put into it all the things I might never have a chance to say to him if the Phoenician turned up. I wanted to let him know how much I loved him and that I had a pretty good time on Earth right up until I was butchered like a steer. At the same time, I didn't want to make myself cry writing the thing. I also didn't want to scrawl anything terminally embarrassing if I wound up spending the night doing crosswords at Mrs. Bukes's kitchen table and nothing happened. In the end, I wrote, "I'm okay. Mr. Bukes asked me to sit with Shelley. They had a fire at his gym. Wow, has his day bit the bag. Love you. The Panama thrill was great." 8. When I opened the door, the wind hit me with a shove, a guest banging past me and reeling drunkenly into the house. I had to back my way out, hunching my shoulders against the gale. But when I got around the corner and was on my way up to the Bukes house, I had the wind at my back. The gusts ran at me, turning my light windbreaker into a sail and carrying me along at a trot. A house on the corner was on the market, and as I went by, the real estate agent's metal sign, which was pitching back and forth, snapped free and soared 20 feet before doing a meat cleaver whap into the soft dirt of someone's front yard. I did not feel I was walking to Shelley's house so much as I was being blown there. A fat, warm drop of water splatted the side of my face, just like a mouthful of spit. The wind surged, and a burst of rain, barely a dozen drops, struck the blacktop ahead of me, producing the smell that is one of the finest odors in the world, the fragrance of hot asphalt in a summer shower. A sound began to build behind me, a thunderous rattle that I could feel in my teeth. It was the sound of torrential downpour driving into trees and against tar paper roofs and parked cars. A mindless, continuous roar. I picked up my pace, but what was coming couldn't be outrun, and in 3 more steps, it caught me. It came down so hard that the rain bounced when it hit the road, creating a shivering knee-high billow of spray. Water began to pour into storm drains in a brown, foaming flood. It was amazing how quickly it happened. It seemed like I ran fewer than 10 steps before I was splashing ankle-deep. A plastic pink flamingo rushed past, carried by the tide. Lightning popped and the world became an X-ray photograph of itself. I forgot my plan. Did I even have a plan? You couldn't think in a storm like that. I fled through pelting water, cut across the yard of the house next to Shelley's. Only the lawn was melting. It came apart under my heels, long runners of grass peeling up to reveal the waterlogged earth beneath. I fell, went down on one knee, caught myself with my hands, and came up filthy and wet. I staggered on, across the Bukes' driveway, which was a wide and shallow canal by then, and around to the back of the house. I scrabbled at the door and leapt inside as if I were on the run from wild dogs. The door banged behind me, only slightly less loud than a crack of thunder, which was when I remembered I'd been aiming for stealth. Water dripped off me, off the party gun. My clothes were sopping. The kitchen was still and shadowed. I had sat there plenty of times in the past, munching Shelley Bukes's date cookies and sipping tea, and it had always been a place of pleasant smells and reassuring order. Now, though, there were dirty plates in the sink. The garbage can overflowed, flies crawling on heaped paper towels and plastic bottles. I listened, but couldn't hear anything except the rain rumbling on the roof. It sounded like a train going by. The screen door opened behind me and slammed again, and I choked on a scream. I spun, ready to drop to my knees and begin begging, but there was no one there. Just wind. I pulled the screen door tight, and almost immediately a fresh gust overpowered the old latch and sucked the screen open once more, then thumped it shut. I didn't bother to secure it again. My insides squirmed at the thought of going any farther into the house. I felt strongly that the Phoenician was already there, had heard me coming in, and was patiently waiting for me somewhere in the gloom, down the hall and around the corner. I opened my mouth to call hello, then thought better of it. What finally got me moving wasn't courage, but manners. A puddle was forming under my feet. I snatched a dish towel and wiped up. It gave me a way to stall going any farther into the house. I liked it close by the screen door, where I could get outside in 2 steps. Finally, the floor was dry. I was still wet, though, and needed a towel myself. I edged over to the doorway and stuck my head around the corner. A dim and lonely hall awaited. I crept down the corridor. I used the barrel of the party gun to nudge open each door as I came to it, and the Phoenician was in every room. He was in the tiny home office, standing motionless in one corner. I spotted him in my peripheral vision, and my pulse did a hectic jig, and I looked again and saw it was only a coat rack. He was in the guest bedroom, too. Oh, at first glance, the place seemed empty. It could have been a room in a Motel 6 with its neatly made queen-sized bed, striped wallpaper, and modest TV. The door to the closet, though, was slightly ajar, and as I stared at it, it seemed to wobble slightly, as if it had only just been pulled closed. I could feel him in there, holding his breath. It took all the will I possessed to walk the 3 steps to the closet. When I threw open the door, I was prepared to die. The little cabinet within contained a collection of curious costumes, a pink jumpsuit with a fur collar, white silks of the sort Elvis Presley liked to wear in the 70s, but no psychopaths. Finally, only the door to the master bedroom remained. I gently turned the knob and carefully pushed it inward. The screen door in the kitchen chose that exact moment to bang once again, going off like a pistol shot. I looked behind me and waited. It came to me then that I was trapped here at the end of the corridor. The only way to get out of the house without leaping through a window was to retrace my steps. I swayed, ready for the Phoenician to step into the hall, planting himself between me and escape. One moment turned into another. No one came. Nothing moved. Rain hammered on the roof. I stuck my head into the bedroom. Shelley was asleep on her side beneath a puffy white comforter, nothing of her showing except her dandelion puff of white hair. Her snore was a soft, rasping buzz, barely audible over the steady rumble of the downpour. I inched into the room in mincing little steps, feeling jumpy and weak, but quite a bit less jumpy and weak than I'd been when I first entered the house. I used the party gun to push aside curtains. There was no one behind them, no one in the closet either. My nerves were still jangly, but I wasn't scared of the house anymore. I didn't see why a guy like the Phoenician would hide in a closet anyway. What kind of predator hid from a fat 13-year-old with a big plastic gun that looked about as threatening as a bullhorn? The signal from Radio Adulthood was sharpening by then, making its way through the usual static of adolescence. The newscaster was reading tonight's report in a dry, droll tone. He reminded me of Carl Sagan's maxim that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. He pointed out that I had, in the past, believed that the Zodiac Killer might break into my house and murder me simply because I'd once read a book about him. He reminded his listeners that Michael Figlioni had, when he was 12, saved his allowance for 6 months to buy a metal detector because he thought there was a strong chance of finding Spanish doubloons buried in his backyard. Radio Adulthood wanted its audience to know that my current theory, that the Phoenician possessed a camera capable of stealing thoughts, was based on the sturdy evidence of an old lady's demented ramblings and a random scuffed snapshot discovered beneath a trash can.
But what about the fire at the gym?
Yes, Radio Adulthood admitted, there'd been a shocking blaze at Mr. Bukes's gym. Considering the lightning storm that had just rolled in, the Cupertino Fire Department would probably be responding to a lot of fires that evening. Did I think perhaps that the storm was also the work of the Phoenician? Was that another of his superpowers? He had a camera that destroyed mines. Did he also have an umbrella that squirted thunderstorms into the sky? I should count myself lucky he hadn't used his sorcery to make it rain nails. That was about all the jeering from Radio Adulthood I wanted to hear at the moment. I was wet, and I was cold, and I was safe, and that was good enough. But later, yes, later, maybe I would be tuning back in to hear the rest of the program. Maybe a part of me was looking forward to tearing myself down, taking a good rip at my own overworked Twilight Zone imagination. I was sick of my soggy clothes and poked my head into the master bathroom. There was a big white robe trimmed in gold thread hanging off a hook by the shower, the kind of robe you'd expect to find in a 5-star hotel. It looked like the next best thing to curling up in a bed somewhere. I patted the party gun dry, set it down next to the sink, and slopped off my wet shirt. I left the door open between the bathroom and the bedroom, but I stood behind it, so if Shelley Bukes woke, she wouldn't be startled by the sight of my exposed pink blubber. The rain was slackening by then, had softened to a deep lulling crackle on the roof. As I toweled off my boy boobs and back, I felt myself softening with it. I had planned to sit in the kitchen, next to the screen door, ready to run at the first sign of a psycho, but now I was beginning to indulge fantasies of hot cocoa and Girl Scout cookies. The rain was tapering off, but the lightning was still going full throttle. It flashed close enough to fill the bathroom with a throb of almost blinding silver light. I wrestled off my pants, which were soaked through. I peeled off my waterlogged socks, too. The lightning blinked again, the brightest flash yet. I wiggled into the robe. It was even softer and fluffier than I'd imagined. It was like wearing an Ewok. I toweled off my wet hair, my neck, and the lightning snapped for a third time, and Shelley responded to it with a low moan of unhappiness. Then I understood, and I wanted to moan myself. All those flashes of lightning, and not one crack of thunder. Fear inflated within me like a balloon, a thing expanding in my midsection, pushing organs out of the way. The white glare flashed again, not outside, but from within the bedroom. There was a single window in the bathroom, but I wasn't getting out that way. It was made of glass bricks, set inside the shower, and couldn't be opened. The only way out was past him. I reached for my party gun with a shaking hand. I thought that maybe I could throw it at him, at his face, and run. I peeked around the edge of the door. My pulse thrummed. The flash flashed. The Phoenician stood by the bed, bent over Shelley with his camera, peering through the viewfinder. He had pulled the covers completely off her. Shelley was curled on her side, a hand protecting her face, but as I watched, the Phoenician grabbed her wrist and forced her arm down. "None of that," he said. "Let's see you." The flash went off again, and the camera whirred. The Solarid spit a photo onto the floor. Shelley made a low, wounded sound of refusal, a noise that was almost, but not quite, no. A heap of snapshots surrounded his fancy boots with the high Cuban heels. The flash pulsed again, and another picture fell into the pile. I took a small step into the bedroom. Even that required too much coordination for a shambling slob like myself, and the party gun clicked against the doorframe. The sound of it made me want to cry, but the Phoenician didn't look my way, so intent was he on his work. The camera whined and snapped. Shelley tried to raise her hand to shield her face again. "No, bitch," he said, and grabbed her wrist and shoved her hand down. "What did I tell you? No covering up." "Stop it," I said. It was out of my mouth before I knew I was going to speak. It was the way he kept shoving her hand down. It offended me. Does that make sense? I wanted more than anything to run, but I couldn't, because I couldn't bear the thought of him touching her like that. It was indecent. He glanced over his shoulder without any real surprise, flicked his gaze down at the party gun, and snorted softly in contempt. It wasn't fooling anyone. "Oh, look," he said. "It's the fat boy. I thought the old bastard might send someone around to sit with her. Of all the people in the world, if it could have been just one person, I would have picked you, fat boy. I'm going to remember the next few minutes with great pleasure, all the rest of my life. I am. But you aren't." He turned toward me with the camera. I jerked up the gun. I'm sure I meant to throw it, but instead my finger found the trigger. The air horn shrieked, confetti exploded in a shower of glitter, the flash bulbs kapowed. The Phoenician went backward as if someone had struck him in the chest. His high right heel came down on that little pile of photographs, those slick plasticky squares, and squirted out from under him. The backs of his legs thumped an end table, a lamp toppled, hit the floor, and the bulb exploded with a sharp pop. He jumped forward a step, and Shelley reached out and grabbed his pant leg and yanked. He stumbled, with his eyes shut, right toward me. He made a sound between a snarl and a roar. Glitter spackled his cheeks, flecked his eyelashes. He even had some in his mouth, bright gold flakes on his tongue. He cradled his camera to his chest like a mother with her infant and reached for me with his free hand. In that moment, I found a decisive grace I'd never known before and would never know again. I stepped into him. Knowing he couldn't see me, had been blinded by the flash. When we thudded together, the Solarid slipped. My knee found his groin. Not a good hard thump, but a weak jostle that made him instinctively clamp his knees together. He bobbled the camera, and I lifted it right out of his hand. He choked on a scream and grabbed for the Solarid. I handed him the party gun instead. He caught it by the trigger and it went off with another loud squawk. I kept going, was past him in two steps, and then I was behind him next to the bed. He stumbled almost as far as the bedroom door before he realized what had happened. He put out his free hand and steadied himself against the doorframe. He blinked rapidly down at the party gun with complete bafflement. He didn't drop it. He threw it onto the floor with a crack and kicked it away. A hand stroked the outside of my leg, gently patted my knee. Shelley. She had relaxed and gazed up at me with a dreaming affection. The pale, colorless worms of the Phoenician's lips flexed in a look of rage masquerading as humor. "You can't imagine what I'm going to do to you. I'm not going to kill you. I'm not even going to hurt you. Either would be showing you a respect you don't deserve. I'm going to fucking erase you. His dark eyes shifted to the camera in my hands, then went back to my face. Put that down, you